Broadcasting from the Civic Cypher Studios, welcome to the QR Code, where we share perspective, seek understanding, and shape outcomes. I go by the name Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward, and it's good to be talking to you guys again.
Yeah, man. And we want you to stick around. Today, we are going to do a history lesson. You know, a lot of the stuff we talk about on the show requires context, and we're not always able to provide as much context in the moment when we're covering, you know, stories as we'd like to. So today we're kind of focused on going back into time and providing a baseline, a framework upon which a lot of the stories that we tell and a lot of things that you read in the news can be placed. And so we want you to stay tuned, because we're going to talk about the role of Black history in Black life, and why that's so important and how we're able to connect to it. And, you know, and the same is true for other, you know, marginalized communities. But obviously we're able to tell Black stories because Q and I are both Black men. But history really matters. And in a time when history is kind of under attack and in schools and in the public sector and so forth, you know, we feel like we need to kind of let people know why that's so important. We're also going to talk about slavery. I know, but, you know, American slavery was very different from other types of slavery. And as a result, the outcomes in this country with respect to the former slave, enslaved people is very different. So we're going to talk about that and make those connections. We're also going to share a document known as the Willie Lynch Letter, which does give some insight into the way of thinking from those times. And we're going to break that down. And we're also going to talk about why Black and white churches are so segregated. And, you know, you wouldn't really know unless we told you, but there's a reason for that. So stay tuned for that and so much more. But first up, it's time for our feel-good feature. And today's feel-good feature comes from ABC News. This might not sound like it feels good, you know, but I think it's good. So the remains of 19 Black Americans whose skulls were taken to Leipzig, Germany in the 1880s to perform racial pseudoscience experiments were brought to New Orleans to be properly memorialized, a repatriation committee said Thursday. Dillard University, the city of New Orleans and University Medical Center will hold a New Orleans-style jazz funeral on Saturday morning for the 13 men, 4 women, and 2 unidentified people, according to Dr. Monique Gilroy, the president of the historically Black Louisiana University. Quote, "They were people with names," Gilroy said at a press conference on Thursday. She goes on to say, they were people with stories and history. Some of them had families, mothers, fathers, daughters, sons, human beings, not specimens, not numbers. Unquote. Dr. Eva Baum, chair of the Dillard University's Cultural Repatriation Committee, said during the press conference that the University of Leipzig reached out to the city of New Orleans in 2023 and offered to repatriate the remains. The Cultural Repatriation Committee, formed in 2024, and looked through the public records to identify exactly who the people were and establish a genealogy, according to Baum. The group has not been able to identify any descendants at this point, she noted. Okay, so why is this good news? These people were taken, these were enslaved people, taken to Germany and studied, I guess, to try to justify their inferiority, to validate their, I guess, subhuman characteristics, and to justify slavery, again, using bogus science, pseudoscience. And now these people will be able to rest, hopefully, near where the rest of their families are resting. And so we call that good news, because it's not nothing. All right. I see you, Q. So I wanted to start today's episode off, you know, talking about the role of Black history and the role that it plays in Black life. And, you know, Q and I, obviously, we talked about this beforehand, before we got to the mics and, you know, had a chance to talk to you. And we had some idea of what we wanted to talk about. But I think that the best example to let people know how special history it is to know your history, especially when so much of it is hidden from you in schools. You know, you don't get your history, you don't have context or, a mental framework of who you are, where you are, why you're there, and what standing you have relative to other people. And it's very easy to just think, well, this is the way it's supposed to be because I'm inferior, or because they're superior, or because I'm not good enough, or they're better than me, or these sorts of things, right? Or any number of things, right? But one of the things that Q and I talked about was, you know what? There was a moment where we were really able to kind of be immersed in our history and see the world on the other side of that experience with a newfound clarity and a newfound appreciation for our history, a huge dose of it. And Q and I are very fortunate in that we've had mentors and, you know, people that have made sure that we knew a good amount of our history, but there's so much of it that we could not know because, again, the history that we are taught in this country, especially going through the public school system, is really based on one particular vantage point. And so there are a lot of gaps where other people have made contributions, other stories have needed to be told, and so forth. And so Q and I were able to visit the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. And I will let you jump in and start the story, Q, because this is such a perfect example of why Black history is so important.
Jumping in to start the story is difficult because where do you begin? Like, we spent 7 hours there.
Yeah, I remember.
And it wasn't even
close
enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, it definitely wasn't enough. It was an eye-opening experience because so much of that history wasn't like things that we'd never seen or read or heard before. Mm-hmm. But being immersed in those exhibits and surrounded by people that had a genuine curiosity. Because we work in these spaces far too often where the legitimacy of our history, the legitimacy of our self-determination, the legitimacy of our rights is up for debate somehow. And having to spend so much time convincing people that our lives matter, that we're worth it, that we're human beings, that we deserve dignity, and that we deserve the benefit of the doubt. Being surrounded by people who are either their whole lives fully immersed in our history or genuinely curious to know more about it. Like, we weren't challenged in that space. There was nobody there debating with people across the room to prove a point. There was no one there in bad faith. And again, spending that much time there, I feel like if such a person existed or if such a group existed, we would have crossed paths with them because we were, you know, we spent most of our day there and had full intentions to go spend another 7 or 12 hours there. But we just had other things that we had to get to with speaking to kids and traveling to universities. And it was just a really powerful trip for us. But that museum and shouts to the Smithsonian for the work they've always done and for the work they're still trying to do, even while there are, you know, people trying to turn their lights out, literally. Yeah. Looking around at things and they coming to life, you know, looking at, you know, where they laid Emmett Till's body. Yeah. And the thing about history, especially when the entirety of it happens before you're even alive, Emmett Till in my mind, my whole life, like, I knew he died as a young person. I knew that. But his name lives as an adult somehow in my history. The same with Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. These gentlemen didn't make it to be the age that we are now, Rams. Mm-hmm. You know, but because their entire history happened before we were born, they're immortalized in this kind of forever grown-up space.
Yeah.
When they didn't get to live most of the or almost any of their grown-up life, right? Yeah. They, at very, very young ages, Tupac Shakur and, you know, people like that, at very young ages met their demise. So the cultural impact that an Emmett Till had on my life, my mind didn't remember that he was really a baby.
Yeah, his coffin was really tiny.
Seeing that small casket, man, was just like, forgive the term because, you know, neither of us drink, but it was sobering. Like, it kind of shook me to my core and like calibrated the idea in my mind, like, yo, He never got to live his life. And unfortunately, so much of our story is difficult and painful, but not all of it. Some of it is heroic and powerful.
Yeah.
And we walked through that entire music section. And going up that spiral staircase / spiral ramp, we had a moment. I think it was 12:15.
Because they broke it
12:15,
down.
They what?
They broke it down.
They broke it down. So, a hallway full of strangers, without planning to at all, had a moment where Ramses and I kind of distantly heard someone kind of quietly singing, "Lift Every Voice and Sing."
It was etched in the wall. Yeah, and they were reading, singing it. Yeah.
And with no rehearsal, with no planning, with no text group chat to make sure that we all met up at the same time, we just joined in. And then one by one, or two by two, or three by three, other groups just also joined in. And you heard an in sync, in harmony chorus.
Yeah.
Break out in the hallways of this museum, singing the Negro National Anthem, and no one shushed us. Nobody asked us to keep it down. Nobody told us to stop. Everyone joined in like that's what they were there for, man. And it gave me chills, bro. Like, I enjoyed it so much. I was so happy, and I was also in disbelief. Like, it seemed like only in a place like that could a moment like that happen. And that was like the highlight of that day at the museum for me.
So for folks that haven't been here, you know, and we have good relationships with the Civil Rights Museum in Tennessee, and the NAACP Museum as well. And but this moment was really special, and this museum, the layout of it is really incredible. So for folks that haven't been, you start in the basement of the museum, and it's like you're in the bowels of a slave ship, right? Our history didn't start, you know, in a slave ship, but, you know, in terms of this country, it did. You start there and you see all the ships and the manifest and the cargo and how many souls were on board when it picked up at port in Africa, and how many souls got dropped off. And sometimes, you know, it would say zero souls because everybody on the ship died in transit, or, you know, they threw slaves overboard. And then you get out of there and you walk through the timeline of the country. You know, you see, you know, Harriet Tubman's handkerchief, and you see, you know, things from Rosa Parks and Bibles from these leaders, and, you know, just artifacts from these people that you hear about. Of course, we get to Emmett Till. You see the segregation period. You see the buses and the lunch counters and, you know, the whites only segments. You see Barack Obama. You see Clarence Thomas, someone that, of course, we don't politically agree with, but he's black and he's in there. A little tiny picture relative to everyone else. But and the thing is, I'm saying these names and sharing these stories is because these are popular ones that you might know, but it's the in-between that makes it all live. It's like, okay, how many people came before this person to create the world that this person can thrive in, and the sacrifices and those untold stories. And it energized us. It imbued us with, you know, a renewed sense of passion and purpose. And anybody that attacks Black history, I think, is in the wrong for that. So that's the role Black history plays. Now, a topic that a lot of people really have a problem with. You know, why do you always got to bring up slavery? Slavery was a million years ago. You didn't pick any cotton. You weren't a slave. I didn't own any slaves. Why is this a thing? Why do I owe you reparations? Like, why should I have to subsidize your reparations? This, you know, these are conversations that Q and I have from exasperated people. People are exhausted of talking about it. And listen, nobody's more exhausted talking about it than us. Okay. I want to say that slavery is not something that it's very difficult to be proud of coming from slaves. You know what I'm saying? There's no dignity in that. the resilience of the formerly enslaved people, that's definitely something to be proud of. I am incredibly proud of that. I hope to continue in that legacy, but that's not a flex to say I came from some slaves. So bringing it up is not, isn't, you know, it's for anything, it's context, okay? But a lot of people don't get it. And one of the things that people say is like, look, man, slaves, Jewish people were slaves. There's slavery all around the world. And one of the things I'd like to do today is kind of paint a picture of how slavery in this country was different than slavery elsewhere. As a result, the black people in this country have very different experiences and very different outcomes relative to black people in other places. You know what I mean? Certainly in Africa. So when people say black people are this way because of whatever, that kind of breaks down once you leave the borders of the United States, which then implies that there are systems in the United States that are affecting black people specifically and uniquely than other parts of the world. How did this come about? Well, it is true that slaves were purchased from Africans. Now, not all slaves were purchased, but slaves were purchased from Africans. So that is something that, you know, we'll say. But one of the things that, you know, we've pushed back on, and Q, you can jump in if you have anything to add here. But one of the things we pushed back on is, like, if you change the name or change slave in your mind, change it to like child slave. Okay. It's still slavery. If you think slavery is wrong and blah, 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 to help it live, to help to imbue it with some humanity, think child slave. Okay. So we're going to read this again. Child slaves were purchased from Africa. You know, people like to say, well, they sold you guys into slavery, so, you know, it's their fault, right? Well, who buys slaves? Who buys child slaves? You know, they bought children too. They bought women. Who buys those people? Are those the good guys? Right? And so they use this, well, the slaves were purchased fair and square to try to distance themselves from responsibility. If you went and bought a human being, you're the bad guy. You're not supposed to do that. It's immoral, right? And of course, you're not supposed to sell it. But one of the differences about Africans is in Africa, when tribes went to war and they conquered other tribes, when they had thieves, when they had criminals, those people would become enslaved. But, you know, their children would not be enslaved. You know what I mean? Those people would be enslaved, but they would not be permanently enslaved. It would be like a sentence. And different, depending on where you went, some of those slaves were integrated into the society. You can marry into, you know, a society or whatever, a conquered tribe, whatever. Very different than in the United States, right? Also, because of the economics of slavery, it kind of created a whole new economic institution. So tribes started going to war solely so that they could get more slaves to sell to the British, sell to the Americas, right? So the influence of white folks, if we're talking black and white, on the slave trade cannot be overstated, right? Let's talk about this. We talked about slaves in Africa living within a more flexible kinship groups system and being able to marry into families. In the United States, slavery was based on race. That's it. That's not true in Africa. Okay? It never, how could it be true, right? Oh, there was slavery in Africa. They just purchased the slaves and brought them here. No, it was not based on race. You could not be born and, okay, you're darker skin, so you're a slave. That was not how that worked. That was an American invention, okay? And just another twisting of the knife here is that, you know, at the end of the day, at least insofar as Brits were concerned, reparations were paid to the slaveholders. In the Americas, reparations were paid to the slaveholders. Reparations have never been paid to slaves. Well, formerly enslaved, their descendants, none of that, right? So people that have this argument, rather, about slavery and, you know, the effects of it, the implications of it, they try to distance it. It was a million years ago. It means nothing now. You didn't pick cotton. I didn't own a slave. and then they push back on the reparations conversation. They have to do so much in the way of mental gymnastics to get to that point. Because I would imagine you have to, because if you're confronted with the fact that, okay, so the slave owners got reparations, the people that did the work didn't get anything, and this country has said that, okay, that's wrong, we shouldn't have done that, and there was a program in place to give the slaves 40 acres and a mule, and it was scrapped once Lincoln got assassinated. So this country has never really reconciled with that great sin of enslaving human beings, nor has it really honestly confronted the legacy of slavery, the Jim Crows, the black codes, the redlining, you know, the systemic oppression, the unfair dissemination of the GI Bill, just the second class citizenship, the relegation of black folks to a second class citizenship. Going all the way back, all the way up until modern times, we're talking about the war on drugs, unfair housing. We're talking about, environmental racism. We're talking about, healthcare outcomes, on and on and on, where it's like, okay, these are systemic, some visible, some invisible. We talked about invisible systems, white women being able to call the police on a black man, even if there was no black man present, they just pick up somebody to blame. They know that system exists, which is why they can always blame a black man and get sympathy. It's an invisible system. And the failure to acknowledge that is something that continues to work against us. And I could make an argument and tie that directly back to slavery, and it wouldn't be difficult. They've always pitted black men versus white women as though somehow white women were vulnerable and we were somehow criminal. But, go to Africa where everybody's African and there's no more criminal people relative to other people, right? You could argue that poor people engage in criminal behavior, but that's true anywhere. I know I'm talking a lot. I just wanted to paint a full enough picture, Q. I know we got like a couple minutes left, but I didn't want to talk that all the way up, but I wanted to get those points out.
No, all of it was necessary. Some people, believe it or not, will be having this conversation for the first time with us, or, learning some of these things for the first time with us, because slavery is an idea for some people, especially younger people, born in the last 30 years. Slavery does feel like it was 500 years ago. It does feel like it's seven generations ago. But, we're talking about two lifetimes.
Yeah. How much 18, wealth could you pass on in that?
18. Well, no. Two lifetimes since the legal end of it. How long it lasts is much longer. So the amount of wealth and land and the head start they got from slavery happening is one thing. But I mean, how long ago slavery was relative to people's idea is so much further back, right? So you're talking about 1865 when Juneteenth had the last enslaved learn that they had been free already. Yeah. My mother was born in 1945. Right? So say her mother was born in 1920. Say her mother was born in 1900. One more relative was a slave.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So it's like these systems that existed were not eons ago. And then the effects of slavery, we felt that until what, 50 years ago, 60 years ago?
That was as long as Jim Crow lasted, yeah.
Yeah, as an example, my mother, who was born in 1945, when she turned 18, couldn't vote because it was illegal.
Your mother?
My mom, not my grandma, not her mom, not her grandma, my mother. My pastor. That's how real and close the impact of American slavery is.
And, in talking about the legacy of that, people need to know that racism is expensive. So, for today's better, do better. I feel like this should go out to all of us. We all need to do better, right? Racism is expensive. And it's more than, we need to do more than just not be racist. We need to adopt anti-racist policies. I'm going to share a bit from the Griot. Maryland Governor Wes Moore is on the front lines in the fight to close the racial wealth gap in America, and he hopes his actions in his state will serve as a model across the country. Quote, let's be clear, the racial wealth gap has cost this country about $16 trillion in GDP over the past two decades. This is from Moore, who unveiled the latest actions he's taking to close the racial wealth gap in Maryland. Goes on to say, racism is expensive. Bigotry is expensive. America's only black governor told the griot. Goes on to say, and the reason that we're moving to be able to address the racial wealth gap by focusing on both assets and access is because it's actually going to help our economy, end quote. Moore announced nearly 7,000 additional state pardons for simple marijuana possession and the first batch of designated just communities to receive priority funding opportunities for housing and community development, many of which are historically black and experienced decades of disinvestment as a result of racially discriminatory practices like redlining and urban highway construction. That's another thing people need to look at. It just decimated black communities everywhere, and every major city is the highway system. All right. Governor Moore emphasized that repairing the harm to black communities caused by these practices and ending the existing ones like unfair housing appraisals is critical to building black wealth. Quote, it's one of the greatest wealth thefts that we have seen in our nation's history, unquote, he declared. Moore continued, quote, you can have more people becoming homeowners. You can have more home value being increased. You can have more entrepreneurs and black entrepreneurs who are part of a larger landscape. That is going to grow the entire economy, unquote. The governor said that anyone serious about addressing the well-documented historic ills against black Americans has a moral obligation to be able to address it and help fix it. This is why we all need to be anti-racist. Okay. All right. Despite these worries, the governor told the griot, quote, the state of black America is resilient. Tell me when has it not been challenging? Tell me when it's been easy. Moore said of the history of African American struggle dating back to their enslavement in the United States through the post-Reconstruction and Jim Crow eras. Goes on to say, the reason that we are still here, the reason that we still have the freedoms that we have and the rights that are protected in the way that they are is because there are people who fought on our behalf, end quote, Moore reminded. So that's another thing, you know, and you and I have talked about this in past episodes, Q, that racism, whether it's acknowledged explicitly or whether it's, you know, people just like try to ignore it, it is still ugly and it is still costly. Racism doesn't just hurt ethnic minorities. Racism actually hurts everybody. But that sense of superiority over another group of people is intoxicating. I would imagine, you know, I haven't felt that feeling before, but I'd imagine it's something that's addictive. But in terms of black and white, we have never come across, you and I both, as much of these papers and newspaper and articles and stuff and you know, university documents and studies that we have to go through, have never come across one stitch of information that shows the fiscal benefit, a fiscal benefit to racism. Not one. And we've often come across, you know, how it costs black people, certainly, Hispanic people, certainly, you know, other marginalized, gay people, women, certainly. But we've also come across how it hurts white communities, certainly. And so we all need to be a little bit more aggressive in our approach. And, you know, shout out to people that are doing something. Wes Moore, of course, is somebody that he not doing nothing. So, you know, you do what you can, right? Anything to add here, Q? Otherwise, I'll stick it.
No, there's not much to add, man. Racism has shown us that it's more powerful in its ability to create solidarity than anything else, than ethnic group, than gender,
sure, yeah,
than religion, than everything. Christians will vote against Christian beliefs to uphold racism.
Yeah,
poor people will keep themselves poor as long as they can keep other people poor too. Like it is probably the most powerful tie that binds the most people that I've ever seen. Yeah. We see people organize, vote, march, and speak out against their own best interest as long as I can hurt someone else that doesn't look like me. And that is a very, man, kind of insane thing to process in real time because we're watching it happen still today.
You know, the crazy part about this is that for the people that don't know, they really think we're in a post-racial society. If they just took the time to dig into these weeds the way that we have to in order to do our shows, they would see that, hey, pushing back against what we do find in those weeds would actually make everyone's life better, you know? And it doesn't, I wouldn't lie to y'all. I just wouldn't do it. So stick around. We got more coming up.